Thank you, Adam, for the kind introduction. Thank you, all of you, for being here. It's an honor to be to give a professorial lecture at the University of Sussex after a few years arrived. Since this is an inaugural lecture, I will, bear with my accent, so be patient. It's also late in the evening, so my accent goes downstream. So this is my academic tree. I'm going to present myself a little bit more in full. These are my parents, my academic parents. So I trained, my first training was in surgery. I was trained to be a surgeon, then I decided it was not my cup of tea. What I was interested in was neuropsychopharmacology. Trained first in Sapienza, then in the National Research Council in Italy, then at Concordia University in Canada, and then in the States. But I can go over to my grandparents and great-grandparents. It's a distinguished bunch of people. There are a few Nobel Prizes in medicine. There are two people who should have got it. They didn't get it, Penfield and Hebb, for sure. More important than the names, however, it is important the background. And if you can see two components here. One is a hardcore pharmacology and psychopharmacology, and the other is behavioral neuroscience, theory of motivation, etc. The common link is interest in addictive drugs and in drug addiction. And I've also, of course, a clinical background. So I'm interested in drug addiction, and now I'm going to tell you, I forgot to this part of the talk. I moved from this, already Adam said this, so I moved in 1999 to Italy, and I become professor there. And then recently I moved here for three main reasons. This is a very nice slide, by the way. First reason, names, big names. During my training, I learned about University of Sussex two very important people who were associated and affiliated with this university. First and foremost, John Maynard Smith was one of the founders of this university. Of course, also Stuart Sutherland, Nick McIntosh, and Anthony Dickinson. Okay, second reason, maybe sounds strange, but I like the architecture of the University of Sussex. So the UK Embassy in Rome was designed by the same architect who did the campus here, Sir Basil Spence. In Italy, this is called rationalism. Here, it's called brutalism, which now I understand why when I try to be too rational with my colleague, they say that I'm brutal. Third and most important reason, this one is the serious one, at the University of Sussex, there is one of the greatest concentration of people interested in drug and alcohol research. Probably with Cambridge, we are one of the two poles of research on drug addiction in the UK. So this was the slide I was talking about, why you should be interested in drug addiction. Let me give you some reason, aside from the interest in drugs in general. Okay, so this is the prevalence of mental health disorders of different types. As you can see here, addiction is much more prevalent than other common disorders. If you include also substance abuse in general, forget addiction, these are two different things, you can see that this is really a major problem. So now it's very prevalent in the population. Does it make a difference from the point of view of public health? Of course it makes. So this is the drug addiction is probably the leading cause of death as a risk factor in the general population. Look at this. This is a cancer, and this is the reason for the risk factor for cancer: tobacco smoke and alcohol and drug use. Then there is also dietary risk, but this is in some respect can be another type of addiction. In people aged 15 to 14 is really a very important cause of death. So it's a very serious public health concern, and it costs a lot of money. So this is the cost to NHS for cancer care, and this is for substance misuse. This is the total cost to England of drug and alcohol abuse, £30 billion. And tobacco is not included in this. So it's a huge problem with huge costs for society. Okay, so this is the reason why you should be interested to what I'm going to say about drugs. Do we know the causes of addiction? Not really. We think we know more than we actually know. My next slides in the lecture are going to be about this issue. And do we have effective treatments for drug addiction? Actually not. There is very little. Again, I'm going to talk about a little bit about this at the end of my lecture. What do we know? What we think we know? Well, there is a general consensus that drugs, addictive drugs, act on the brain on shared substrates. It is thought that they activate dopaminergic transmission. Maybe you have heard about dopamine. Someone called it the pleasure transmitter and things, obscene terminology to me. So this is just one neurotransmitter in the brain. It's particularly involved in motivation, reward, etc. So this is the idea. All drugs work more or less in the same manner. And by acting in this way, they produce liking and wanting for the drug. Okay. Then there is a more profound aspect of this story, that is the neuroadaptation produced by addictive drugs in the brain. And it's thought that by changing brain neurochemistry at molecular level, changing the expression of genes and inducing epigenetic modification, drugs change permanently the brain and transform a person who is just an abuser into an addict. Okay. So this is the story that it doesn't square with a lot of available evidence, and for sure doesn't found in agreement many scientists, including myself. We try to make this point in this commentary that was recently published, that goes a little bit against the grain of salt in the field. Okay, let me tell you why I personally think that this story is too simplified, this unitary model of drug reward and drug addiction. Okay, first of all, you don't become addicted in general. You become addicted to a given drug. Yes, you can abuse more than one drug, but usually you are an alcoholic, heroin addict, cocaine addict, tobacco smoker. If you're a tobacco smoker, you don't necessarily are a heroin addict. You're not going home and binge drink in the evening. There are different type of addiction. Okay, first of all, why people develop different type of addiction and abuse different type of drugs? Well, some studies have been done on this, especially the study by Candler, using as a subject twins, so to part the genetic component of drug abuse from environmental components. And what they found is that, I'm going to show only the data for heroin and cocaine because these two drugs are going to be the main theme of my presentation. As you can see here, the contribution of genetic factors is very different for the abuse of cocaine versus heroin. Very different contribution. The size is very different. So environmental factors play much greater role for opiate addiction relative to cocaine addiction. Opiates are heroin, morphine, and drugs like this. And if we wonder which are the factors that are responsible for making you a cocaine addict or heroin addict, it's not that your mother or father are abusing cocaine or heroin or alcohol. It is the exposure to unique environmental factors in your life, something that is unique to you, not to people in your family and your relatives. So what are these environmental factors that seems to be so important? We know almost nothing about it, very, very little. We know few things, most at the experimental level, but not much about environmental factors in the real life of addicts. So this presentation now is going to be about some possible mechanisms that are responsible for this modulation by the environment on drug reward. This is what I just said. We know since a while that the setting in which you use drugs can make a big difference. For example, GI in Vietnam, I wouldn't say that almost all of them were addicted to heroin, but a great majority of them, they were heroin users, and many of them were heroin addicts. Yet, back home, most of them stopped. So the drug had been working on their brain for years and years, and yet when they went back home, they stopped being addicted to heroin. They stopped taking heroin altogether. How come? This guy, Zinberg was one of the first to point out the role of setting in shaping the response to addictive drugs. We didn't move much beyond that, so we didn't incorporate yet this very big component of drug addiction into theoretical modeling and into research. And this is what I'm going to try to do in my presentation. So let's move for the moment from humans to animal models, because you can do certain kind of experiments in animals you cannot do with humans. For example, you can control their environment. I promise you, animals in my lab are treated very nicely, and they take drugs, which for most people is a plus. So this is the type of experiment we do. We have rats with intrajugular cannulae, so the when they press the liver, they can get drug into their bloodstream, like intravenous drug users. In our experiment, we have rats that are exposed to two different types of drugs. So if they press on one liver, they can get cocaine. If they press on the other liver, they get heroin. We have to develop a special type of catheters for these experiments. So this is the model that we combined with a model of environmental manipulation. We have to simplify things to understand the neurobiological underpinning. So what we did here, we had two identical physical settings with a major difference. In one setting, the animal are living in the same place where they self-administer the drug. In the other setting, rats arrive into the self-administration chamber only for the testing. So these two environments are physically identical, but for a group of rats, this is home. For the other group of rats, is a club. Okay, so they take the drug outside the home. You think that this makes not much of a difference. It does. Huge difference. These rats tend to prefer heroin to cocaine. These rats tend to prefer cocaine to heroin. These rats takes much more heroin than these rats, and the reverse for these rats. These rats work much harder for heroin than for cocaine, and so on. I'm going to show you only two sets of data. We did many experiments. I want to show you only two sets of data that are particularly interesting to me. Okay. First experiment I'm going to show you. You train the rats for many, many days to self-administer. One day heroin, another day cocaine. Cocaine, heroin, and so on and so on. So these drugs are co-abusers. They co-abuse both drugs. And then one day you ask them, choose heroin or cocaine. Every 10 minutes, pick one of the two drugs. They're mutually exclusive. Then we can measure whether a rat prefer one drug or the other. It's not an absolute choice, but it's a preference. Usually when in the next slide I'm going to talk about rats preferring one drug, it means the rats prefer 70-100% one drug relative to the other. Okay, so this is the result. At home, they tend to prefer heroin. Some rats prefer cocaine. Outside the home, it's the opposite. There is a five-fold shift in the relative ratio of preference cocaine to heroin. Second set, it looks like a serial killer, actually is a very good scientist. So during this presentation, I'm going to show my children. Okay? I'm going to show you my parents and grandparents, and I'm going to show my children. This is the first one. Second set of data. We tried here to model a phenomenon that is very important in drug addiction, that is relapse. The problem with drug addicts is not taking the drug, is to remain without the drug. So the real interesting moment is not when the addicts are taking the drug, but what happens in their brain when they're without drug. They tend to relapse, unfortunately. How you model this in rats? Well, you can train rats to take the drug. These are the number of lever pressing, and these are sessions. So they learn to lever press. They stabilize. This is a model of drug addiction. Then you take away the drug. The rat press the liver and gets nothing. So at the beginning, it gets upset and increases liver pressing. Then gives up and stops pressing the liver. Okay. So now, after this period of abstinence, we can model relapse by exposing the animals to the same stimuli that usually trigger relapse in humans. A stress, condition stimuli, you pass by the bar where you were drinking your beer or your whiskey, or you can give a small amount of drug to the animal. In the words of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are without defense against the first drink. A small amount of drug can push you over the board. So this is what we use indeed. A drug priming, a small amount of drug, and you can see what happened. Rats resume pressing the liver even though there is no drug. They're just pressing for nothing. It's craving the drug, it's not getting the drug. So this increase in liver pressing is a measure, an index of relapse. We adapted this model for our purposes, so we trained the rats to self-administer heroin and cocaine, I've already said it. Then we put them through a period of abstinence, and then we gave them a little taste of heroin and cocaine, or cocaine, one of the two. And you can see how it's working. You press on the liver, it doesn't, nothing happened. Yet, look here. Home, outside the home. This is a priming of heroin. The rats relapse into heroin seeking if they're at home, not when they're outside. And the opposite for cocaine. These are the same rats. So the drug is not invariant to what drug you're exposed to. And it makes a difference where you're taking the drug. Okay. This is Christian who did this work. So why rats do that? Why they prefer heroin at home and cocaine outside? As Eddington, who was a famous British physicist, used to say, I don't believe any empirical data without a theory behind it. I don't agree with that, but then there you are. I developed a model for this. And the model is as such. When you take cocaine, you don't take only cocaine in your brain. You take your cocaine everywhere. And you don't have only an increase in liking and wanting. There are other effects of cocaine you should take into consideration. For example, you get effects in both central arousal and peripheral arousal. So you have tachypnea, you have tachycardia, you have muscular tension. These are all signs of exposure to stress. When you take heroin, you have the opposite effects. Actually, this is what we think happen when you read the literature. But there is very little about this type of data in actual humans and animals. Very, very little. So we assume that this was happening. Actually, I assumed this and elaborated this model. So why this is relevant? Let me explain. You give Homer cocaine at home. Now, liking and wanting cocaine, fine, but there are other effects. Now, why they're important? Because at the same time, Homer realizes that he's at home, quiet, safe environment. The two things do not match. Here there is a mismatch, and this mismatch dampen the rewarding effects of cocaine. So this is my hypothesis. And the opposite, if Homer gets heroin in outside the home. So you get, of course, liking and wanting, but also this other type of information that does not match the fact that you are in an environment that is not safe and quiet. So you get mismatch, also in this case, and you dampen the effect of the drug. You have to test an hypothesis. You cannot use the data you already collected to test it. That's just the starting points. How we tested it? Again, I'm going to give you just a taste of few sets of data. So first of all, let's go back to our rats. How do you measure pleasure in rats? How do you measure affective states in rats? Not very easy. One of the few ways is to monitor ultrasonic vocalization in the range of 50 kilohertz. These are spectra of rats vocalization. It sounds like something similar. Actually, it doesn't sound because you cannot hear it. But it seems to be a very simple experiment. Actually, it's bloody difficult because you need very expensive microphone, very expensive equipment and software, and a person who sacrifices herself for months in analyzing the data. Anyhow, Why they're important? Because these vocalizations are produced when the rats are exposed to pleasurable situations. So it's sort of like they're singing, they're happy. Okay? So let's buy into this hypothesis, because these are just hypotheses, right? But then let's see how they match my hypothesis. Well, it matches the hypothesis very well. Rats vocalize more for heroin at home than for cocaine, and the opposite happens outside the home. There is a shift in affective balance. And this is the heroic students who sat in front of the computer reading second by second the ultrasonic vocalization in animals. Okay, so how does it translate to humans? I resisted to put Trump face here, but I couldn't resist telling you, so I didn't want to involve university in something done. Okay. I don't want to make trouble. Anyway, let's move to humans. We did this experiment in co-abusers, heroin and cocaine co-abusers in Rome, because they offered us the facility for doing these experiments. We tried to do similar things here in England, but it was not that easy. So here we recruited people with a long history of heroin and cocaine co-abuse. Okay. And we did a series of exposed this individual to a series of tests, including fMRI scanning. Right. First set of data. Do addicts prefer heroin at home and cocaine outside the home like our rats? Yes, they do. Actually, the shift is even greater. Now there is a tenfold shift in the preference. Notice, it's not that they don't take cocaine at home or heroin outside. They tend to prefer taking heroin at home and cocaine, heroin at home and cocaine outside. Sometimes I forget the order of my slides. And these are the people who did the study. So rats and humans, on this level, they seem to coincide. Now, the next question is, do these differences correspond to difference in the way the drug reward is processed in the two different settings? And these questions, whether the two drugs produce opposite central and peripheral effects depending on the setting, and whether the neurobiological consequences of drug exposure differ depending on the setting, was the subject of Silvana, which residing there, Silvana De Pilo dissertation. She just submitted this dissertation for her PhD. So I'm going to show this data in a moment. Okay. First of all, do really heroin and cocaine produce opposite effects, central and peripheral effects in humans? Nobody has ever bothered to do this kind of study. So what Silvana did, she interviewed these people, she asked them to fill up questionnaires, VAS scale, etc. And she measured, of course, mainly heart rate, respiratory rate, and muscular tension, but also she took other measures, just to take the entire spectrum of the effect of drugs. And what she found is that indeed the addicts perceive the two drugs as opposites, which is not trivial. Even when you look at other type of function, the two drugs seem to produce opposite spectra of effects. So the first question is answered in the positive. Second question, a little bit more tricky. How do you test for the affective states in humans? You cannot just simply ask a person, oh, did you like this or did you like that? You have to find some subtler way to approach the problem. You want to avoid, first of all, the cognitive level. You want to tap into their emotional state. And Silvana developed this visual test based on a persisting theoretical model supported by emoticons. Basically, this is the pleasant part of the spectrum, this is the unpleasant one. This is the sedation, the feeling, the state of sedation, and this is the state of arousal. So you can have all possible combination of sedation, arousal, pleasure, displeasure. And what she found is this. Heroin at home in addicts who were co-abusing the two drugs, heroin is mostly pleasant. And in most cases, there is a sense of sedation. Very rarely there is an aspect of unpleasantness to it. Now you ask the same individuals how they felt when they took heroin outside the home, and you can see there's a shift. Now many say that they didn't feel okay. They didn't like it that much. Shift, very significant shift in balance, in affective balance. Then you repeat the same question for cocaine. Mind you, are always the same individuals interviewed for the four possible combinations. And you find also in this case a shift in balance. Heroin, cocaine at home mostly produce a dysphoric effect. It's not very pleasant. Much more pleasant outside the home. Okay. So, the first two questions were answering the positive. Now, third question, is what going on in the brain of the addicts different depending on the drug? Now, we couldn't administer heroin or cocaine to this individual for many different reasons, ethics committee, and most important, actually, is not that one of the major problems, is that the drug itself changed brain activity. So it's a confounding factor. What we ask the addict to do is to think about taking the drug. So to do this, there are procedures called emotional visual imagery. So you have to trigger the recollection of drug experience in this experienced co-abuser. So they're going to think about something they've done many times in the past. You put them in an fMRI machine and you ask them to think about this for a long period of time, for, as we will see, 2 minutes. So it's a long procedure. And we ask them to think about all the possible combination of drug and setting. Before going on, let me tell you who are our addicts, because there is a misconception that the addicts are people laying in the street on their last leg. Sometimes they are, but often they are not. These are the people who were tested in this scan. You can see most of them had a job. So these are people you meet in the street, and you don't think they're addicts. A nurse, barman, security. There are British Airways pilot going to the clinic room because it's a free clinic to get their methadone. Also Alitalia pilot, of course. Hostess, steward, you name it. Bankers. So, of course, these are the kind of people who are not volunteering for a fMRI study. Anyway, so these are our subject. This is the procedure we conducted on them. First of all, we asked them to think about being in a specific environment. In this case, they are at home. Okay? And they have to think about this for 60 seconds. Then we asked them, think about taking heroin when you are at home. They are thinking about something they've already done in the past for 2 minutes, drug imagery. Then we ask them, okay, stop thinking, which is very difficult, but at least try not to think. And then we ask them to fill some visual and logic scale. Okay. Then we repeat this over and over with different type of combinations. So we have 8 blocks, counterbalanced, in which the subject has to think about heroin at home, heroin outside, cocaine at home, cocaine outside. And this is what we found. So let me show you first the data concerning people thinking about taking cocaine or heroin at home. These are the brain area that are most involved in processing drug reward, prefrontal cortex and the striatal complex. You can see here that cocaine increases activity much more than heroin at home. The opposite outside the home. These are exactly the same individuals who are doing both tasks. This is the left prefrontal cortex and this is the left caudate. Now, the surprising thing was the involvement of the cerebellum. When I was a medical student, the cerebellum was the part of the brain that when got screwed up was compromising your equilibrium. For neuroscientists, for a long time, the cerebellum basically did not exist, was ignored altogether. Okay. Nowadays, we are thinking more and more about the involvement of cerebellum in many different things, especially contextualization of information. So put information into context. Again, you can see the opposite pattern for heroin and cocaine depending on the setting. So if you want to summarize the information, you have a frontostriatal cortical frontostriatal cerebellar network that get activated in different direction depending on the setting in which the drug is taken, at least is thought to be taken. I hope this is clear. So this circuit seems to be activated more by cocaine at home and by heroin, and by heroin outside the home, and the opposite for the other combination. Okay. What does it mean? First of all, it means I and my collaborators were right, which is good for an academic. This is the most important point. You want to be right, and then the rest comes up. But there are more serious implications. First of all, drugs do not necessarily produce pleasure. You will find this in all textbook, in a website. Drugs are abused because they produce pleasure. I've been a smoker for 10-15 years, heavy smokers. I cannot remember a drop of pleasure out of the cigarette. I just wanted the cigarette. So it is a misconception. Drugs do not necessarily produce pleasure, even when they're addictive. Second, the mechanism of action of different drugs do not overlap completely. They may overlap in part, but it's a minor, I think it's a minor component of drug action. So it's interesting because one of the great tragedy of science is that theory can fail when confronted with facts. And let me tell you, to bring many of my colleagues to confront facts is a very difficult thing. Second and most important set of facts, the environment can change dramatically drug effect. And we are just looking at the role of the setting surrounding drug taking. There are many other ways in which the environment can shape drug effects. So I think that this is a really should be an important starting point to develop innovative therapeutic approaches to the treatment of drug addiction based on digital platform using ecological momentary intervention so that we can monitor and intervene on the life of drug addicts at the moment they're taking drug in real world settings. Let me tell you a word about the state of drug addiction therapy. There is not. The best weapon we have is to pay addicts not to take drugs. In Boston, the police is paying not addicts but gangsters not to kill each other. It is cost effective. It bloody works. There is a small problem from the point of view of the sense of fairness of people. Why should give money to an addict to stop taking drugs? You are giving money no matter what, because then you have to take care of these people. You have to pay the police to take the person and put the person in jail. So you are going to pay, and it's much more effective to pay not to take drugs than to pay for curing them. But as you can understand, it's a controversial approach. Then what we have? A little bit of cognitive behavioral therapy. It works a little bit on some individuals, but not in most others. 12 steps programs, like Alcoholics Anonymous. It works in a few people, not forever, but for a while it works. And then nothing else. We can give other drugs in place of the one they're taking, like methadone and buprenorphine instead of heroin, but those are replacement drugs. Okay? So we don't have really a cure for drug addiction, which is not to say that we are not trying. What I want to say is that maybe we are using the wrong approach. We need an innovative approach which are really the preserve of research intensive university should be. So this is the reason with some colleagues I set up this drug addiction center that involves many faculty in different schools. Literally we have also people from the School of Social Studies, ethnographers who are joining us. We have people in law school, et cetera. We're trying to bring together different type of basic research to shape new approaches, because the one that we have do not work very well. Okay, which is the major obstacle? So we can become really leader, because our only competitors really is Cambridge. And trust me, we can do much better than that. What we needed, I have a grudge against Cambridge. Cambridge is the university up north, Northeast. So we set up this center, we have a nice website. What we do not have is money. And this is not only a problem with drug addiction research, this is a general problem with mental health research, and particularly for drug addiction research. Look at these numbers. I showed you the major risk factor for cancer is drug abuse. That's the major risk factor. And yet, a pittance is given to mental health research and drug addiction research in particular. But worse than what the state is doing is what charities are doing. Nobody gives money to study drug addiction because the drug addicts are dirty and bad people. That's the idea. I cannot see any other reason. Look at this. For every pound the state spends, public give to charity almost £3. 0.01 pounds in the case of drug addiction research. Actually, mental health research. So this is the ratio in amount of money spent per patient for cancer relative to mental health problem. It's a dramatic problem, a dramatic problem. So what I want from you, adopt a penguin. Okay, climate change is important, except, but really, adopt a penguin because it's an adorable animal and is vulnerable. Adopt an addict. They are not always adorable. Sometimes they are very unpleasant to deal with. Silvana objects to this, but not because she's an addict, because she thinks addicts are much better than most people. But they are fellow humans, and they're incredibly vulnerable. And they're in this condition not because there is something mean in them, but because of the circumstances they were exposed to or the genes they got. The best way to help is not to give money to an addict so she or he can spend it in drugs, but to give money to research. So I invite you to write down this website and tell around to people that you can donate to us. And you can get into this website, which I think some improvement can be done on this website, because it doesn't look like very enticing for donation. But you can see that there is the possibility to donate to the Sussex Addiction Research Intervention Center. If you don't want to give money to us, why not? You can give money to other institutions investigating drug addiction. Okay, so I'm at the end of the story here. Just a big thank to the people who collaborated in this project. And first and foremost to Silvana De Piro, Riccardo Bisari, Daniele Caprioli, Cristian Montanari, Alessandro Dubla, Vera Spagnolo, and my colleagues at Sussex and other institutions who collaborated, and to all my colleagues in the School of Psychology, and of course, the entire faculty body in the university. Thank you very much. Was I very fast?
No, you were very clear. I told you in between, I'm delighted to welcome Verity Brogan from St Andrews, who's going to give you a vote.
Thanks.
As Verity's coming up, you remember, I hope you remember, that Professor Orlich was going to take questions we have. Verity's going to thank Aldo and Amber.
Thank you very much, Pastor. It gives me very great pleasure to offer this vote of thanks to Professor Aldo Aldiali for his fascinating inaugural lecture. I'm sure you all appreciate now, if you didn't realize this before, if you weren't already familiar with his extensive research, that Aldo brings to Sussex a remarkable variety of skills. Throw away comments like, we have to design a catheter. Even commenting that a student who has to sit and analyze ultrasonic vocalizations, it is a lot of hard work, somebody had to teach them how to do that. Just the sheer breadth of the methodology that Aldo is bringing to this research is deeply impressive, to work with rats and people and in these different contexts, and fMRI research and clinical research is very, very impressive. So Sussex has got a really quite remarkable and versatile talent. So as we've heard this evening from Aldo, not all drugs are the same. He probably already had a pretty good idea about that. I mean, after all, why would we have a drug classification system if all drugs were the same? Why do some drugs become more popular in some societies than others? Nevertheless, it's a really commonly held view that the classification of drugs is more about potency or how illegally or how dangerous they are to society. And the drugs which are acceptable just come in different societies to have different uses. But nevertheless, we all have this sense that they somehow do the same thing. They stimulate a pleasure centre, and that's why they're addictive. And these views are surprisingly persistent, even in the face of contradictory evidence of the kind that Aldo is presenting in his research. Even the Surgeon General of the United States, Jerome Adams, recently espoused this very view, that the reinforcing effects of all addictive drugs are to come down to one brain chemical, dopamine, the pleasure chemical. He also repeated the very out-of-date notion that dopamine equates with pleasure, just per se, conflating the concept of reinforcement and reward. Aldo, in the excellent company of four other internationally prominent researchers, none of whom was shy of some controversy, it must be said, set him right, of course. I was surprised we didn't see Donald tweeting about this insult to the Surgeon General for the criticism. Nevertheless, the Surgeon General is, as I have said, in very good company in this belief. And it's therefore something for Sussex to be very proud of that they had somebody, that they had the insight to attract Aldo here to join you and to make a difference to addiction research in the way that he's doing. The UK in general, as Aldo pointed out, and Sussex in particular, has a very well-deserved reputation for research in addiction research. The meticulous and clever science that we've heard about tonight will ensure that Sussex will stay at the forefront. So now my comments are only standing between you and the great pleasure outside, which awaits you, which is the alcohol. It's all to do with GABA, by the way, nothing to do with dopamine. So with that and without further ado, I would like to invite you to thank Aldo in the usual way and then join him outside. You can talk to him about his research for more over a lovely glass of wine. Thank you very much.